Aloha. It's 4 o'clock. Time now for Out of the Box. You're listening to KKCR Honolulu, KAQA Kilauea, Kauai Community Radio. I'm your host, Dave Giroux. Jonathan Jay will be here in just a few minutes. He's running a little late on the road. So if you see him flying up behind you, pull over and let him through so he can get to the studio. Okay, let's see. Out of the Box is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with the following wwonderful underwriters.
Alahale Wellness Center, natural pain relief services, providing gentle chiropractic, acupuncture, therapeutic massage, nutritional wellness, electromagnetic cellular therapy, and spinal rehab. Most major health insurance plans and Medicare accepted. Open Monday through Friday, 332-5580 or online at kalaheochiropractic.com.
HawaiiGaga.com, Hawaii Vacation Rental Directory and Vacation Guide. A proud sponsor of Kauai Community Radio, Hawaii Gaga also publishes the Kauai GPS Tour Guide, an audio tour of Kauai for iPhones. More information online at HawaiiGaga.com.
Shh, it's KKCR's Silent Fun Drive. From now until the start of our spring membership drive on May 5th, we encourage you to participate in our Silent Drive. All Silent Drive contributors will be entered into a drawing to win a couple's massage at one of the several Hawaiian rainforest spas on Kauai. Help us reach our goal by making a donation today by calling 826-7774 or online at kkcr.org. KKCR,
the views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, board, volunteers, or underwriters.
That's right. Jumped the gun there a little bit on that last announcement. I think you get the idea, though. Okay, so this is Out of the Box, and we've got a few topics we're going to be covering today. And the first one, I've got a caller on the air right now, on the phone right now, who's going to tell us about what's going on in Mahalapu at the dairy site. So I'm going to bring on Bridget Hammerquist. Hello, Bridget, you there? Hello, you there?
Yes, I am. I'm here.
Okay, can you hear me all right?
I can, thank you.
Okay, you're coming in great. Okay, so you are a member of a group of concerned citizens that are interested or worried about what's going on in at the dairy site in Mahalapu. You tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
Okay. I think it's fair to say that everybody that has been participating in this are people who live here. Actually, we're all actually kind of fond of agriculture. Some of us are actively engaged in agricultural pursuits. And we, you know, we want it to be safe and not hurt the environment, the reefs, you know, our wildlife. And we met by going to presentations given by Hawaii Dairy Farms. They've had three public meetings, and they had a public meeting with people that worked at the resorts on the South Shore. And they pass out literature at the public meetings, and we heard what they had to say. And as we heard what they described, you know, we kind of met each other, just sitting next to each other, and we were, like, concerned. And so then we kind of exchanged information and said, hey, we should maybe get together and take a look at this. This sounds pretty intense, like it's going to be, wow, quite a lot of stuff in a really small area.
Right. Just to let our listeners know, then, there's a proposal on the books. Actually, it's kind of far along here, it seems like. They're already moving dirt out there now. And they want to put a dairy, 2,000 cattle, on 500 acres, 580 acres in the Mahalapu area, a couple miles northeast, I guess, of Poipu. And so what are you concerned about then? I mean, does it doesn't sound like a good idea to be having this sort of operation in that area, or what are you guys concerned about?
Well, as we looked at dairy farms that are typically done in the United States, generally, when you're talking about a grass-fed model, which is the way they describe this, you're looking at one cow per 1.5, 2.5 acres in climates that are good, growing climates. In climates where there's, you know, freezing and winter and that sort of thing, there's more acreage per cow because when they're grass-fed, they have to be assured that the grass is going to regenerate and going to be there to feed the cow. And this model also is being delivered to the public as a grass-fed, primarily dairy. They do say 30% of their feed will be grain, and people have asked, will it be GMO-free? And they've said, no, it'll be GMO grain. So they're not trying for organic milk. But our big concern is that the 582-acre farm is really not 582 acres for the 2,000 cows, but they take almost 200 acres off of the 582, and they actually come down to less than 360 acres for grazing. So for those of us that have been around farms, less than 360 acres for more than 1,800 animals is a really tough ratio. And then we heard that they're dividing that grazing area, which is less than 360 total acres. They're dividing it into 119 fenced parcels, each parcel to be 2 to 3 acres. And so they're going to divide the herd up, so they use 6 parcels at a time. And they call these groupings mobs of cows. And so they're going to have 300 to 330 size mob on 6 parcels for 4 to 6 hours. Then they're going to move to another 6, 4 to 6 hours. And then a third 6 in every 24-hour period. And the last 6 parcels of 2 to 3 acres, they're going to stay on through the night. So they'll be there 10 to 12 hours. They're planning on them leaving their poop and pee on the ground, their manure and urine on the ground. They're planning on that helping to feed the grass. And then they said 8 to 10% of what they put out every day will be done in the milking parlor where they milk them. And they wash that down, and it goes to what's called a holding pond. And then they told us that they're going to need to spray a diluted content of the holding pond back on the pastures. And, you know, men who were really more knowledgeable about this than myself said, wait, what a minute. If you're only using 48 acres a day and each cow produces about 110 pounds, that's the number they give it. Google will tell you it's more, but if you use the numbers that they have, 110 pounds of manure and urine a day, it's like 198,000 pounds of waste per day for an 1,880-head herd. So
now they call this, in their proposal, they call this the New Zealand model. I mean, what does that mean? It sounds more like a feedlot to me.
Well, they did say that they based this on a New Zealand model. So we went and studied what they were doing in New Zealand and learned that in New Zealand they use a formula of 1 cow per acre. This is a much more intense pulse rotational scheme that they developed because they said we have such great weather here, the grass will regenerate. And people in the audience asked them what type of grass, and they said kikuyu grass because it grows in ideal settings. Kikuyu grass can grow 1 inch an hour, but that's not with, you know, 300, 900-pound cows standing on it and eating it. And kikuyu grass is known for doing best above 500-foot elevation, and the farm's going to be at 35 to 65 feet above sea level. So it's not the natural habitat for even the kikuyu that is here, and there's going to be a lot of animals standing on it and eating it for 4 to 6 hour intervals. We did the math. They're using 18 of these parcels per day. They've got a total of 119 of them. So every 6.2 days, they'll rotate through all of the 119 parcels. So then we asked ourselves, is it possible the grass can regenerate in 6 days under that amount of waste? And the waste that gets spread over the 48 acres per day is 94,000 tons. So that's a lot.
Right.
And then they're talking about being a zero elimination dairy. It took a while for us to understand what does that really mean. And that means they can't discharge any of the pee or poo off the farm site. So they told us, this grass is going to need so much food, we're going to have to spray the effluent pond back onto the pastures. And, you know, people that were there commenting were like, wow, that sounds like a tremendous amount. Is the grass going to burn? And so we've worked, we've attended the meetings, you know, we've studied their proposal, and some of the people in the group are, you know, biologists, some are chemists, just people from different walks of life. And one of the participants are people from, actually, Surfrider, joined in our letter of concern that we filed with the county. Malama Mahalapu has had people attend our meetings. Sierra Club also joined. They had a letter that went to the county endorsing where we're coming from with our concerns. But the bottom line is we don't think it's physically possible. We're not against dairies at all. But we don't think it's physically possible to take that much manure and urine on that small an area from that many animals and keep it on the farm.
Right. Hey, we're joined in the studio here with Jonathan Jay, my co-host.
Aloha. Thanks for calling in, Bridget. Really appreciate it.
No problem.
Yeah, so like you, I was never an expert about tropical dairy farming practices, so I did a little research online, and I found a book called Tropical Dairy Farming, Calf Rearing, Heifer Rearing, and Forage Conservation by a fellow named John Moran. He's a senior scientist with the Department of Primary Industries in Victoria. And he advocates for a small holder farms with no more than 20 to 50 head of cattle. And yet here we have with this Mahalapu mess of 2,000 cows, that's like 20 times more.
Yeah, I mean, their herd size, they said, is going to be about 1,880 up to 2,000. They said they're going to cap it at 2,000.
Yeah, that's a massive industrial project.
It is. It's what they call an intense industrial dairy.
Yeah, and the way you described these checkerboards of little tiny pens that the cows get pushed through from day to day to day, that doesn't seem like happy cows out in the field grazing. It sounds like cows getting pushed around like pawns on a gigantic chessboard.
They aren't free-range grazing at all. I mean, to call it grass-fed is a nice euphemism.
Yeah, it sounds great.
But they're going to be, and this is on their website. People who are listening can check this out. HawaiiDairyFarms.com has a website, and they describe 119 2 to 3 acre parcels. So, you know, in your head, to kind of wrap on around this, you know, a 2 to 3 acre parcel, we thought, well, what is, it's kind of the size of,
about the size of a football field, yeah?
Baseball field, yeah.
Okay.
And maybe even a little bit on the upside of a baseball field.
Okay.
But the idea that you have to come to is, okay, if it's one of the 2 acre parcels and they've got 300 to 330, they're always going to have that size group on each parcel. That's 150 cows per acre.
Yeah, that's a lot more than 3 to 4 or 1 to 2 cows per acre.
Oh, yeah. And even dairy advocates in the United States don't push it anywhere near. I mean, nobody. We did ask. People in the audience asked, do you know of any other dairy anywhere in the United States that grazes like this, that keeps
pulse
300
group,
to
yeah.
330 on a 2 to 3 acre parcel round the clock? The only time they come out is if they're sick, if they're having a cow, if they're birthing, or when they get milked every day. They're going to get milked 2 times a day, and the milking process, they're going to take one mob of 300 to 330.
A mob of cows.
That's what they call it, a mob.
Okay,
They said that's the jargon, that's the language.
Like a murder of crows, but a mob of cows.
They take the mob over to the milking parlor.
Milking parlor. That sounds nice, that they all sit down and order drinks or something.
Yeah, but that is currently in the industry, that's what they're called. And so they hook them up. They have a rotational scheme. They go through and they hook them up to milking machines.
Do you have any information about this gigantic mechanical milking machine, high speed milking?
Yes. Yeah. They had described in their proposal, And they're pushing it to the max because they're talking about putting 300 to 330 through every hour.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like...
Which means they're on a milking machine and supposed to ingest...
Feeding, yeah.
They're 30% grain.
Uh-huh.
They have two times, so they have to do 15% of their diet in the first 10-minute milking of the day, and they have to do the other 15% of their diet of grain in the second 10 minutes of the day because they get two 10-minute milking times.
And how much milk are they going to suck out of each cow in this miraculous 10 minutes?
Well, they're planning on doing 10 to 12 gallons a day, so 5 to 6 each time they're milked.
Hmm.
And their projection is to produce 3.7 million gallons of milk a year.
But this milk now, it's not organic. It's not primarily grass-fed. It's not the GMO corn feed is not going to be organic. The processing for the milk is not going to be locally on the island. It's going to go to Oahu. So the jobs go to Oahu, too, and then the milk gets shipped back and forth across the islands. It doesn't seem like happy cows, and it doesn't seem like a nice organic dairy that everyone sort of dreams about when they hear, oh, hey, a dairy's coming to Kauai.
No, they were very clear in answers to public questions that it's not intended to be an organic dairy. And they have said that maybe at some time in the future, if the opportunity presents itself and a bottler opens up on Kauai, you know, they would be open to bottling here. But for right now, they said the infrastructure isn't there. They can't handle the milk on Kauai. So it's getting shipped to Oahu. And then when asked at the Lihue Business Association meeting that happened March 27th, who they have their contract with, because at earlier meetings they said they were still in the negotiation phase, they identified Meadow Gold as the party that would buy the milk from them, and then Meadow Gold will pasteurize it, bottle it, and then it's Meadow Gold's milk.
Wasn't there just a big scandal involving Meadow Gold a short period ago?
Well, I don't know if you'd call it a scandal. I know there was a problem with a Moloa'a dairy that Meadow Gold ran, and they were discharging onto neighboring property. In other words, the manure and urine weren't being kept on the farm. And they ultimately made the decision to close the dairy because they said it wasn't economically feasible to take the steps they needed to...
Sure, run a sanitary dairy.
Well, or run one that wasn't discharging.
Well, I used to drive by that dairy every day, and it was... The odor from that operation was horrendous. You have to hold your nose as you drove by it, and your eyes were tearing for about a mile until you got up the hill and got past the dairy. It was really bad. And I wonder how this compares to what we had back then. If it's, you know, I don't know how many cows they had per acre or what their operation was any different then, but that I wouldn't want in my backyard.
Well, thanks for introducing the Hawaiian word of the day today, Dave. That's pilau.
Pilau.
Pilau. Yeah, that means a terrible and disgusting odor.
Well, this dairy is supposed to be different because Moloa'a, as I understand it, was a true confined dairy where the cows were in pens. They were in stalls. They weren't out on the grass. And if you... have part grass-fed, if they're all grass-fed, the odor is the best. If they're part grass-fed and part grain-fed, the odor is supposed to be less intense. But the difficulty here is there's so many of them.
Right, the scale.
The Moloa'a dairy, the max they had was 400 cows. Okay, you have to quadruple that plus.
Yeah, five times almost.
Yes, it would be five times if they're at their maximum herd size of 2,000. And they do want to bring in more cows. I mean, they had a public statement to the Star Advertiser in Honolulu that they want to get up to 10,000 cows somewhere
what?
In Hawaii.
Where? What? 10,000?
Well, they're talking about opening up on other islands as well, right?
Yes. I mean, they're talking about opening other dairies. They haven't said if it was other islands or our island. They've just said their ultimate goal is to have 10,000 cows. And... this is what was frightening to us because as we read about the New Zealand model, they do this thing there where they have these intense farms, and they create what are referred to as dairy alleys, where they put build them all next to each other.
Sure, kind of aggregate the industry.
And then they share the milking parlor, because that high-tech stuff is expensive. So this dairy is going to be using the milking parlor for, they said, 10 a.m., 4 a.m. to 10 a.m., and then 4 p.m. to 8, how was it? 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. So it's a six-hour span each time, 4 a.m. to 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. And that raised the issue of the lights in the parlor and how are they going to protect the shearwater birds,
sure.
Dual shearwater birds that are in there. This is one of their habitats.
Sure, absolutely. They get disoriented by the lights.
Yep. So they said they're considering low-voltage lighting. And many of us, you know, that were there to hear that thought, yeah, Bobby, good, because the feds will be in to find you if you don't. I mean, we know what happened just recently on Island where there was high-intensity lighting being used along the coast. They got fined.
Sure. Well, Hawaiian Dairy Farms is a multi-million-dollar endeavor, and they have access to a heck of a lot of capital since they're bankrolled by a billionaire. So it doesn't seem unreasonable that if they don't have the infrastructure here on the island for jobs and local manufacture, that they simply could create that. But let's talk a little bit about density. You've talked about scale, like this is sheer size of the operation. Maybe you could talk more, a little bit more about density. And one of the big problems with density is disease.
It is. And there's a lot of literature that you can read on the Internet. For instance, they had a problem with a really bad E. coli outbreak at a Taco John's in the Midwest. They traced the actual strain of E. coli to some lettuce that was grown in Tulare County, and the neighboring farm to that lettuce farm was a dairy. So they sampled the lettuce, found the particular strain that had sickened people, went next door and sampled the manure and found it in the manure. And they identified it as the same strain. They linked the chain. They didn't ever settle on the exact vector. In other words, what took it from the manure to the lettuce, but they felt that flies may have done it or birds who land on the manure to eat the grubs out of the manure. And then the birds or the flies go land on the lettuce, and then the lettuce got harvested and went. And some strains of bacteria and parasites aren't easy to wash off. You know, even if they wash the lettuce, it doesn't necessarily all come off. It can get embedded down inside, whatever. So they had over 300 people sickened in this one incident, and they had three of them die. And they have had a couple in the mainland issues like this develop where, you know, animal operations that had manure were next to agricultural operations. And, you know, one of our thoughts in looking at the intensity, Jonathan, is the fact that there's a taro plantation right next to where the dairy is going to be. And so, you know, with this volume of manure and urine, it's not improbable that it can discharge and eliminate and seep over to the neighboring waterways that are going into the taro fields.
Yeah, I got to protect the kalo.
Yeah, and could make people sick. I mean, well, some of this stuff can't, some of the more resistant strains of E. coli are very difficult to even cook and make them safe.
Sure. Well, it's not just diseases that can be passed on directly to humans. When you have a density of cows in a mechanized milking process, you get the cows can give diseases to each other. You have problems with pneumonia, bloat, scours, pulpy kidney. I didn't know any of these things before I looked them up online, but none of them sound good. And the way that industrialized farming typically responds to these diseases is to pump the cows full of antibiotics.
More antibiotics.
So, and that gets into the milk, and people drink that, and that's no good for our endocrine systems and stuff. So you take a step back from this, and you got to wonder, okay, it's the scale seems inappropriate. The density seems inappropriate. It's not organic. It's using GMO corn as feed. What are they doing right?
Well, you know, we didn't want to just be critical for the sake of being critical, because we weren't. We were trying to see, okay, how can this work? Could it be good for the islands? And, you know, that special ag land down there, it has a special designation. So you certainly don't want it to get so intensely deposited with manure and urine that it ruins the land, you know, because they have a phosphorus and nitrate buildup that happens when they put that much manure and urine on the ground. And they said, well, no, it's going to be needed. The grass is going to take it up. It's got to need it to grow. And they told publicly a number of times that they had been to the University of Hawaii. They'd gone to the grass specialist there who's published in the field of the type of grass they're using, that he's helped them select the kukuyu grass, that he'd given them advice about the planting. And, I mean, I was attending all these meetings, and I heard a woman ask him directly, what kind of kukuyu strain are you using? What kind of variety? Because she wanted to know if it was maybe a new kid on the block, something else to come become an invasive species, because kukuyu in itself is invasive, but there's many, many, many varieties of kukuyu.
It's and like it's already
19 varieties. So she said, which one is it? And he said, you know, we'll have to check with our specialist, Dr. Lee. So one of the people that we were talking to try to get educated, you know, it just didn't sound right. He was a professor. His name is William Kranz, University of Nebraska. He said, Bridget, go talk to Dr. Lee. I don't believe he gave them this advice. That's too small an area. In 6 days or 7 days, those pastures will not regrow. That's too much manure, too much, they call it nutrient manure.
Yeah,
too much nutrient for the grass.
Nutrient load.
Too big a load, right. So we did. One of the group contacted Dr. Lee and said, you know, this is what we're hearing at these public meetings. This is what's being presented to us on paper. And, you know, is this really accurate that you advise them that this will grow in this short of time and be sufficient? We'll give them the feed they need for 70% grass-fed? And we got an email back from him in print. He puts, I have not, capital N-O-T, he wrote.
Capital N-O-T.
Yeah.
So he was shouting the not.
Yeah, I haven't consulted with these people. And then he emailed the other members of his department. We didn't know who they were. We didn't know their email addresses. He put it in his response. And he actually recommended that Jackie Hoban, the woman who was on this quest to try to find out, does this grass really grow like they say? Is it really going to be there to be eaten like they say? He said, you might want to talk to Matt Stevenson. He's really the specialist on Kauai. And I think he's a great guy, Matt Stevenson, because he said, you know, he gave a very even-handed answer. He's out there to help farmers. He's out there to help dairy people. He does want them to do it right. He wants the land protected.
Sure. I think everybody does. Even Amy Hennessy,
yeah,
the HDF Hawaii Dairy Farm spokeswoman, she said, quote, we don't want to do something that's harmful.
Okay, well, Matt said, in his opinion, assuming all 580 acres were being grazed on.
Which they're not, according to.
They're not, right? We know they're not.
Right.
He said the highest number of animals he would recommend being put on that parcel is 372.
So, again, one cow per acre as opposed to six or seven.
Yeah, well, it's actually one cow for a little more than an acre. So,
okay, good.
Yeah, it's more like one and a half. And then if you take the 372 that he recommended on the 580, and you say, okay, so it's under 360 that they have, 360 is like about 60% of the 580. So then you reduce his number by 40%, right? So
actually, I'm having a hard time following the math in my head as you're saying it.
Well, if he was working with 580 acres, and we know they're grazing on less than 360. 360 acres is about 60% of that 580.
Okay.
Okay. So then I said to myself, okay, so if Matt says 372 for 580 acres, what's 60% of 372?
Aha, now a little light bulb went on. So So 60%, that would be even less. Is that like 240 or something, 250?
Yeah, it's a little less than that, but right, that's right. And so it's more like 200 and some, yeah, below 200. So you're getting back to a little more than, at least more than an acre per cow.
Right, and they have five times that amount.
Yes, they do. And they, and the way they're grazing them, Jonathan, the thing I can't unfocus on is 300 to 330 on either a 2 or 3 acre parcel, 20 hours a day, 7 days a week. They're never going to roam on anything free. There's going to be either a density of 100 cows per acre or 150 cows per acre when they're using a 2 acre parcel.
Huh, that's a lot of cows in a little space.
It is. It is. It's like when they have a 3 acre space, it gives them an area that's like 20 by 20.
Oh, per cow.
Yeah, when they have a 2 acre space, it's 2/3 of that. So you're at like 15 by 15.
Huh, that's getting to be tiny. That's about the size of the studio that we're broadcasting from right now. I wouldn't want to have a lot of cows in here.
Well, and then picture that cow in your studio, the 15 by 15.
Whoa, hey, back away there. Get away from the tapes.
Eating for 4 to 6 hours on that area. Do you think the grass is going to hold up for 4 to 6 hours?
I don't even think the carpet would hold up.
So, Bridget,
no, you're supposed to pretend there's grass in there, Jonathan.
Bridget, where are we now in the process here? Is this a done deal now? Or
not by any means. No, and
I mean, they're moving dirt out there.
They're grubbing and
They are preparing the pasture, and that's agricultural prep, and they get to do that. They got an exemption for their grubbing and grading permit because it's an ag operation.
It doesn't mean that the soil that's been disturbed and exposed knows it's an agricultural operation, and it doesn't mean that it won't erode.
No, it doesn't. But they're charged with the responsibility of being good stewards, and it's illegal if they discharge it into the streams or the ocean, which isn't very far away. The upper northeastmost corner is supposedly on a diagonal 2.5 miles from the Hyatt. So if you drop your right triangle and go down to Mahalapu Beach, it's probably more like 1.8 miles. And then if you go to the bottom of the farm, where the sludge pads are that they're going to dump.
The what?
They're sludge pads. They have 100 acres devoted to 4 25-acre sludge pads.
What is a sludge pad?
Well, they have these effluent
sound
ponds,
very
right,
attractive.
Where they wash the urine and poop that fall in the milking parlor and that fall on the roadways where they're moving the cows, because they poop while they're being moved, and they especially apparently like to poop while they're being milked.
I know I do.
And that gets washed, and it goes into these holding ponds. And the holding pond settles out, and the manure goes to the bottom, and the liquid comes to the top. And then it goes into a second tank where it's supposed to be just the liquid. And the liquid they call the green waste.
Green, and some sort of liquid effluvium.
It's not green, though, I'll tell you that.
No, yeah. The effluent, yeah. Yeah. So then they dilute that, they say, in a ratio of 10 to 1, and they spray it back on the pastures. And this gets into that advice about the grass thing, because...
Well, yeah, let's. I don't want to miss something you said about the grass and the expert that the dairy pointed to. You said, if I understood you correctly, that the expert that they cited had not been contacted by them or had not given them his advice. That's like a lie. What's up with that?
I don't know. They'd actually contacted him, and I don't want to miscue on that one, but he'd never connected with them. But he had tried. He actually, in his email back to us, detailed 3 dates. He had the dates and the times. He said, they called me on this date. I called them back on this date and got a machine. I called back a second time and got the person who called me, but he was on his way to a plane and we couldn't talk, and he agreed to call me later, and I've never heard from him since. So there was clearly no exchange of advice. So when you get back to this issue of spraying the effluent ponds, they have to put it back on the fields because it's a closed system. It's a no discharge, zero discharge dairy. So they're not putting it anywhere else. It's got to go back on the pastures. And then the solids that settle out.
Oh, yeah, the good parts.
Yeah. That they empty every 90 days onto these four 25-acre parcels. So 100 acres of the farm they're going to take and make into sludge pads. And they're going to try and plant grass in the sludge pads and try and use the manure that they spray out there. But Professor Kranz told me that when they desludge, when they spray that stuff on the 25-acre parcel, and they have to liquefy it to spray it, they told us that at the meetings too, they said that, it's going to smell really, really, really bad all around there. The odor's going to travel for miles.
Yeah, which brings us back to our Hawaiian word for the day here, pilau.
Yeah, and just it just doesn't make sense to put something like this, of this scale, next to a resort community. You know,
well, I mean, is there
it generates, that resort community generates millions of dollars.
I mean, is there anywhere on Kauai where this would be acceptable, you think?
This scale, this intensity, yeah. This industrialized, mechanized right. farming?
Well, based on what we've learned from the people we've spoken to, the area of land that they intend to use to graze on is not big enough for the manure load. It just is not. There's no grass that will regenerate sufficiently. And Matt Stevenson even said that in his email. He said, I know of no variety of grass that will regrow sufficiently to provide a herd this size 70% of its diet or even 100% of its diet.
Not with this intensity of cow impact.
Not with the number of cows per the number of grazing acres, right. Sure, there's other land on Kauai. I mean, we see it when we're driving around, right? I mean, there's stuff up Mauka of Knutson Pass. There's stuff up at, behind Kilohana. I mean, there's stuff up in Kilauea. You know, there's pastures to be had. I don't think they could do it on this scale without harming the environment ever, anywhere on the island or on any island.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it's sustainable. So I can't imagine why anyone who lives here who loves Kauai would want that to be brought here. It doesn't make any sense to me. And it's not just local news. It's not just local radio stations like us or the Star Advertiser. I read about this in the Miami Herald, making waves in the Pacific. A story about sour milk.
Oh. Yeah, I'm sure it's being talked about because it's not done anywhere else in the United States, and they've chosen Kauai to be the experimental startup, and as a Kauai resident, I mean, I don't think that's really a good thing to do. I think it'd be much safer, especially since they're so close to the ocean. I mean, one discharge of that manure, one rainy day, and it goes sliding off into the bay. The coral's dead. It cannot withstand the nitrates that are in the ammonia and the sulfates that are in this manure. It can't. It'll die. And, you know, one of our interested, hardworking people that's tried to help understand and really look into this, Dr. Carl Berg, marine biologist on the island, he's published in the field.
Sure. What does he know?
A lot. And he said, you know, you don't have any room for error. I mean, the state says, well, as soon as they discharge, even one time, it gets off the farm even one time, they have to come in and go through NPDES permit process. They have to get an environmental impact study. They'll have to have public hearings. And they'll be in trouble with the state. But on the flip side of that, you've already got reef damage because you can't stop it once it leaks.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Out of the Box with Dave Giroux and myself, Jonathan Jay. We're speaking with Bridget Hammerquist, who's a concerned citizen from Koloa. We're talking about the HDF, Hawaii Dairy Farm, that's intended to go into Mahalulepu, and the intense large-scale project. If you have any questions or comments you'd like to call in, our number is 826-7771. I want to thank you, Bridget, for sharing with us all that you've learned. I don't presume that you were a dairy expert or ever wanted to be one when you grew up, but It seems like you've learned a lot, and I want to thank you for sharing that with us.
Thanks. The closest I came, I was born and raised on the Big Island and then came to Kauai when I was 17, is 4-H projects. But, you know, the New Zealand model that they're intensifying, people can look at what's happened with dairy in New Zealand, and they do have a national pollution crisis now that their governmental bodies are working very hard to undo the damage that's been done.
Well, one of the things that's interesting to me about New Zealand, as opposed to here, is New Zealand is not tropical. They are a temperate place. It gets cold in the wintertime and warm in the summertime. We're a tropical place. We have a completely different kind of seasonal cycle. We've got a caller who is standing by. I would like to ask a question if you would be so inclined.
Oh, yeah, it's fine with me.
Hello, caller.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks so much. What has been the response of the Grand Hyatts, Grand Poobahs, in relation to this proposed project?
Well, I know that they sent a formal letter to Hawaii Dairy Farms asking them to start on a much smaller scale and allow for, you know, an appreciation of what environmental impact might be had, because there's going to be flies. We have an entomologist on island, Carlos White, who has written actually some letters to the editor about, you know, the fly problem and how hard it is to manage. With that much manure on the ground, it's going to attract a lot of flies. The flies easily travel the 2.5 mile distance, or the 1.8 mile distance to the Hyatt from the lower portion of the farm off the sludge pads. And, you know, they've said, please start small and let's see how. They haven't said you need to stop, you need to move. I think they've been very gracious neighbors. I think the Hyatt's been wonderful. And they've just said, please start real small. Let's see how it goes. 200 cows. Okay, let's see how it goes. And, you know, I was at the Lihue Business Association meeting where the Hawaii Dairy Farms representative said it's not economically feasible to start small.
Well, if it's not economically feasible to start small, then I guess they could just never start.
And may I ask a second question?
Yeah.
Have the folks who were proposing this project been open to... because I heard your later, it was a wonderful program, I heard your later, your earlier testimony regarding on Hawaii Kai and Wai. You were making that presentation?
Yes.
And, you know, you were saying that, you know, on some days it's been recorded that in that area in Mahalapu Valley that there was sometimes up to 11 inches of rain, and therefore the land could not, regardless of whatever type of grass was there, could not really absorb all this excess material. And so I was just wondering, do you think these people who are proposing this project would be open to some green kind of enterprise in, like, collecting some of this extra, you know, effluent, poop or whatever, excuse my French, and, like, using it in an organic kind of composting business? I mean, do you think that would be a practical way of dealing with a potential excess of this material?
It may be.
Okay,
I mean,
Colin,
I don't
we'll
know
take that off the air.
Feasibility for getting it off, you know, in 3-acre parcels. I don't know how it would be to remove it, but it sure would be one thing to consider if they could get it off, because the caller's right. I mean, that amount of rainfall that he reported was when we had a hurricane. But they do have 8-9-inch days just in normal stormy weather. And more important than the 8-inch day or the 9-inch day is the fact that we have a lot of consecutive days of rain. And I know that sometimes you'll have as much as 17 inches in just 3 days.
Hmm.
So that's when your ground is really saturated.
Yeah,
really,
I mean, it's all surface runoff at that point.
Yeah. And there's no way. I mean, I asked Professor Kranz, how are you going to keep it on the farm during the rainy season? And he said, well, you're not. And that's not comforting.
Well, if folks are intrigued by what they've heard and want to learn more or want to contact you or get involved in some way, how can they do that?
Well, they can. I'm happy to respond any way I can. And I think you guys probably have my email or my phone number, and I don't mind it being shared with concerned listeners. I would just encourage people to, you know, write to the county. Let the county know how you feel about it. Let them know if you're as nervous as we are. I think the people in the county are trying to do the right thing. I think they got persuaded with the feel-good aspect of it. You know, we're here to make milk for your Kwai's kids. And then when you get right down to it, well, the milk's going elsewhere. It may never come back to Kwai, or if it comes back to Kwai, it's going to come back depending upon how Metal Gold distributes it, because they're buying it. Once they buy it, they sell it where they sell it.
And they mix it all up and puree it with other milk, and then it's GMO corn-fed, not organic.
They're real clear. They're not intending to sell this as organic milk.
All right, we have another caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello?
Aloha, caller. Welcome to Out of the Box. We're speaking with Bridget Hammerquist about milk on Kauai.
I appreciate all this information that you're supplying. You know, I agree with you. I think this is a terrible idea. It's just ridiculous. It's going to end up creating such a problem. It's doomed to failure. I mean, the city council, they're supposed to be smart. They're not supposed to be kind of lackadaisical, it feels good. Yeah. You know, they're supposed to do stuff like what you're doing right now to be informed and educated about what's really going on. That's what they get paid the big bucks for doing. And I, aside from everything that you've mentioned, the one caller, it's not going to be organic cow poop. First of all,
good point.
Scratch that idea. And obviously, you know, you feel sorry for the cows. And probably this company, who probably realizes on paper that this isn't going to really work, this grass-fed, you know, 150 cows on 1 acre, you know, so we'll just do it like that other milk dairy that you mentioned, Dave, that we'll just keep them in little stalls and feed them. GMO feed. And that's how we'll do it because, you know, I mean, and I guess I can't say any more except that, you know, I'm with anybody who wants to demonstrate and make a stand, even though it seems like a done deal. It's just the worst idea. It's another agricultural, let's take advantage
of. No, now don't give up. Don't give up. I'm here to tell you. We met with the state on Monday.
Really?
A group of concerned citizens, yeah, went to Honolulu. We met, and they were really gracious. The state wastewater and clean water branch people met with us, and they don't have their permits yet. It's not a done deal.
Good. Okay, yeah.
And the city and the county council are looking into it, but the county council is not in a position to approve or disapprove the project because it's regulated by the state and the Soil and Water Conservation District. So those are kind of like other regulatory bodies, right, that are responsible for this. And the good news is that Hawaii Dairy Farms has been asked and has agreed to submit a new comprehensive nutrient management plan. So they have to answer these grass issues that are coming up that suggest the grass can't possibly thrive under that nutrient load.
Yeah, it'll burn up, that grass. It'll destroy itself, you know.
Yeah, so they're in the process of reformulating their plan now, and their options are really twofold. They either get more land somewhere, or they reduce the size of the herd to make the numbers work. Because as Tom France of California told me, who's a longtime expert in this area, or Professor Kranz back at the University of Nebraska, this on paper just won't make it, and he predicted it would not get through the permitting process, and I'm here to tell you, it hasn't gotten through the permitting process. There are still hurdles that they have two permits to get and approval to get from the state of Hawaii before they can operate. So it's not by any means a done deal. So for any of your listeners that are concerned, write letters, write to the State Department of Health, write to the county, ask them to deliver your message to the Soil and Water Conservation District. You know, we got to show our concern. We've got a beautiful place to protect. And that's really the motivation for those of us that have been putting in really lots of time. It's because we care. And Mahalapu is probably one of the best gems we have on the island. I mean, she's beautiful. And she's still nearly pristine, and she's home to the rare and endangered blind cave spider, only found in Kaloa and Mahalepu. Nowhere else in the world, that little cute blind cave spider. Now, should that stop a project? No. But should a project be concerned?
Well, wait. Why not?
Well,
if it's the only one in the world and there's no other like it anywhere else.
No. It's endemic to Kaloa and Mahalepu. And then we have the Kaloa duck. And we have the Newell Shearwater birds that there's actually like a bird sanctuary in there. And we're our next communication and what we're trying to do now is contact the U.S. Fisheries and Wildlife because they actually have identified protected habitats along the coast. And guess what? Mahalepu is one of them. So we're going to go to them and say, help. This is proposed to go in there, and we don't want it to hurt.
Well, thank you very much, Bridget, for all of the work that you've done. And I would love to be able to give out your number on the air, if that's okay with you, for folks who want to contact you and get involved as well.
It's okay. My husband might mind.
Would you rather email?
No. Well, you know, email is good and probably safer for the sanity of the rest of the family. But it's just my full name. It's B-R-I-D-G-E-T, Bridge with a T, Bridget. And then the last name, Hammerquist, H-A-M-M-E-R-Q-U-I-S-T, at HawaiianTel.net, all one word, H-A-W-A-I-I-A-N-T-E-L, HawaiianTel.net.
All right, well, we'll be repeating that email contact a little later. For folks who didn't get their pencils out in time. But I want to thank you again for coming by and sharing all of your mana'o and what you recently learned about the dairy farms on Kauai.
And I really have to give credit to our whole hui, as the Star Advertiser calls it, because everybody, I mean, Dr. Berg, you know, Don Haycock, who's DNLR fisheries biologist on the island, Eileen Kacholian, she's an artist on island. Jackie Hoban is a former dairy person. Her dad had cattle, and her sister managed a dairy, and she knew about cows. And Jackie's really the one that came to me and said, Bridge, you got to help with this. You know, it's a big problem. And I frankly didn't know then what I've since learned. And amidst a lot, so it's taken a lot of people to really get on top of it. But I think we understand now what they're proposing to do, and it's not good.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more about this issue in the future. All right.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Aloha.
Aloha.
Yeah, if we're going to do something, we really ought to do it right, because it would be a terrible shame for all of this stuff to wash into the sea, and then everybody's crying over spilled milk. That's just no good.
Right. Hey, I've got a... let's see, we've got another segment coming up just after 5 o'clock here. I got a couple of quick news things here I want to jump into before then. So both related to GMOs, and there's been some big movement here in the GMO field, anti-GMO field, that is. Vermont just passed a bill that would require labeling of all foods with GMO ingredients. The governor has the bill on his desk now. He is expected to sign it. But if not, it passed by an overwhelming majority in both houses of the legislature, so it probably would not withstand, or it would be overcome by veto. It will become the first state to approve GMO labeling. Now, two other states have passed it, but they both stipulated that it will not go into effect until a certain number of other states also passed similar laws, because they didn't want to be the only one or require all this labeling just for their state, and that was Connecticut and Maine. But it's expected to have a huge impact into the, even though this only pertains to Vermont, it's supposed to have a huge impact nationally because, you know, once labels go out, you know, pretty much the same from state to state. And then people are also going to see that some food products that say that they're natural are also containing GMOs. And so that's going to kind of ring a bell to a lot of consumers when they see what's going on there, and that it's going to bring up a lot of questions to that. It's interesting. I saw a quote in this one article by a executive of Monsanto Seed Company, and he admitted that if you ever see a GMO label, you may as well put a skull and crossbones on it, because that's what the consumer is going to see. So Vermont hopefully becoming the first state to pass a GMO labeling bill. Something was considered in the Hawaii legislature this year. I don't know where it is. It passed out of committee. It was going through hearings. I'm not sure exactly where it is at this point. Didn't sound like something was going to get passed this year. And then also on Maui, anti-GMO activists just turned in a petition with 10,000 signatures to put a ballot on the or a measure on the ballot in November to ban all GMO growing in Maui County, which would also include Molokai.
Sure, as well as Lanai.
And Lanai, yeah. I don't know if there's much growing of GMOs on Lanai at this point. I know Molokai is big. So the county is now verifying the signatures, and if they need 8,500, so they had an extra 20%. If that passes, it will be on the ballot in November. So that should be kind of interesting to see what happens between now and then, and whether or not that gets passed. Okay, well, it's 5 o'clock. And you're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, Kauai Community Radio. And you're listening to Out of the Box. And this show is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with the following underwriters. Check these out.
Aya's Garden, all-natural garden and greenhouse supply. In Kapa'a, down Kukui Street from the Dragon Building. Fertilizers, amendments, soil, seeds, garden and farm organic growing supplies. Open Monday through Saturday. More information at 822-7333 or visit Aya's Garden on Facebook.
Neil Norman and the Hawaii Life Brokerage Ohana proudly supports GMO-free Kauai, agricultural biodiversity, and sustainable farming practices such as community gardens, food forests, seed saving, and beekeeping. Malama aina.
Laser Bear and Kona Brewing Company proudly present Jimmy Vaughn and the Tilt-A-Whirl Band featuring Luann Barton, Friday, April 25th at the Kauai Beach Resort, Jasmine Ballroom. Opening act, Texas guitar innovator Chris Duarte acoustic solo, followed by Smoke and Joe Kubek and Benoit King. Doors open at 6:30, show starts at 7:30. That's Jimmy Vaughn and the Tilt-A-Whirl Band, Friday, April 25th at the Kauai Beach Resort. Information in Gold Circle available at 808-896-4845 or online at laserbear.com. That's LazarBear.com.
Okay, and I think I have one more. No, is that right? That's it.
Welcome back to Out of the Box here on KKCR. It's your weekly call-in community affairs show. We just finished talking about the Mahalepu proposed dairy project, and we're going to go into a new segment now.
Before you go on, we just had a caller that would like to steer you toward a, and that's a little pun there. A book called The Omnivore's Dilemma.
Is that Mr. Palin?
Michael Pollan.
Pollan,
are you familiar with that book?
I am. The Omnivore's Dilemma.
Yeah. It's about how cows are raised and treated in this country, and according to the caller, is very informative.
Yeah, that's for sure. Thanks. That was a great segment. What we're going to do now is we're going to talk about SB 2175. That's the Relating to Industrial Hemp Bill. It recently passed out of committee 24-0. And I believe it will become law if the governor puts his little John Hancock on it. On the phone with us, I'd like to introduce Representative Cynthia Thielen. She's served with the 50th District in Kailua and Kaneohe Bay over on Oahu since 1990, and she's the Assistant Minority Leader. She's been the Vice Chair of Energy and Environmental Protection Committee and is the ranking member for the Judiciary as well as the Consumer Protection, Commerce, and Water and Land Committees. Are you with us on the phone there?
I certainly am. Is this Jonathan?
This is.
Oh, hi. I'm so glad to be on to talk to you about the industrial hemp bill. It's been a 20-year effort, and I would like to let you know that one of the people that lives on the island of Kauai is the one that really started this forward. It's my son, Peter Thielen, who shortly after I was elected came to see me and talked to me about the sugar plantations that were going out of business and all the workers were being unemployed. And Peter said, why doesn't Hawaii grow industrial hemp? And then we could use the sugar land and have a product, a crop that has 25,000 uses, none of which will get you high. It's
well, there are other things in the world doing besides getting high.
Oh, it's an amazing crop. First of all, Henry Ford used to run his original cars on hemp seed oil. They didn't have gasoline, petroleum-based, oil-based gasoline at that point, and so the cars were run on vegetable oil, and hemp was one of the products. He also made portions of the car with hemp-based plastic. That wasn't petroleum-based like they are now. It was the vegetable, different types of products. He could take a sledgehammer to the fenders, and they wouldn't even bend.
And is this because they were made out of sort of a hemp-based fiberglass-type material with using the hemp fibers instead of plastic?
The hemp fibers are excellent, and I'll tell you my big passion, Jonathan, is to be able to do our buildings out of hempcrete. You grow the crop, and you process portions of that and mix it with lime, which is here locally. We wouldn't have to import that at all. And you put in a binder, and you make what's called a kind of a concrete material, a hempcrete, and while it's wet, you can run your electrical wires and your plumbing pipes up through the framed area, and then you put down the hempcrete, and it sets up in about 45 minutes, and then you can move the framing apparatus on up as you build your walls. It's an amazing crop, and it's termite-proof because of the lime content. So we could grow our building materials right on the islands, and they would be able to, for once, be able to have a product, a construction product that the termites won't eat.
Well, that sounds pretty exciting.
I beg your pardon?
That sounds pretty exciting.
It does. It does, and I'm very excited about it. I think that's one of the better uses. But before that, this project, Senate Bill 2175, the House Draft 2 is the one that's going on up to the governor. It will set up a phytoremediation project.
Yeah, now that's an awfully, awfully big word.
I know. What it is using a plant to pull contaminants from the soil. And the industrial hemp plant root can grow to 8 feet below the surface of the land. So as it goes down there, it accumulates the contaminants from the soil and brings it up into the plant itself. You can, after the crop cleans up the soil, you can use the crop itself for industrial purposes, such as biodiesel fuels, industrial lubricants and varnishes, a lot of different things. So it's a wonderful way to go and clean up any contaminated agricultural land that we have in the islands.
Yeah, and I think we have a lot.
Will start that research project.
I think that we have a lot of contaminated lands. I know that pineapple agriculture industry, when it was bigger in the 40s and 50s and 60s, uses a tremendously potent amount of toxic materials like DDT even.
You're absolutely correct.
For weed
suppression.
So
here comes a plant that you can put into the soil and it'll clean those contaminants up. right now there's a contaminated site over at one of our high schools on Oahu. And instead of going in and with bulldozers and that just expensive way of removing all the soil, you can leave the soil in place, plant the hemp crop, and then be able to pull the contaminants out of the soil. We're going to be meeting with leaders in the Department of Education specifically to talk about this and using that site as the test site to get the phytoremediation project going.
Cynthia, why is it, this is Dave Giroux anyway, I'm the co-host here, why is it that we have to go with a study, research project approach to growing industrial hemp when it's been grown for thousands of years on the planet, and it's several countries in the world right now grow it as a normal crop? I mean, why
That's
can't we just do that?
That's an excellent question, and it's because back in the, I guess in the 40s or even the late 30s, there were some competing interests that were wanted to take over from the hemp kind of crop, and those were the oil industry, which looked at hemp as a competitor.
Yeah, to their nylon cordage and rope.
And the timber industry. Randolph Hearst, who would rather have timber be the basis for paper, and hemp was cheaper, better, lasted longer, but it was a competitor. So as the bill that was now sort of morphed into the Controlled Substances Act, the Federal Controlled Substances Act, it expanded its reach, and it included then industrial hemp, even though industrial hemp was not a drug, and that congressional members in hemp-growing states had been assured that the Controlled Substances Act would not stop the hemp farming. During World War II, the federal government had a huge campaign for farmers to grow hemp for
that
the victory effort.
Hemp for victory?
Yes. And then after that, I think the last crop was harvested in 1957. And then the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, came in and said, you can't grow it unless you get a permit. Come to us for a permit. And they never gave any, with one exception. Hawaii did get a permit from the DEA in 1999 and ran a three-year project to determine which location in the world had the hemp seed that would grow the best in Hawaii. And people would probably say Europe, Ukraine, Russia. That's wrong. It's China. And China hemp seed is the best for our location in the world.
Is that because we're more of a tropical location?
I'm not sure. I'm not a scientist, so I don't know. But the research that was done by the principal investigator in that 1999 one is the 1991 project, pardon me, 1999 project. He made that determination. We didn't go far enough there to go into the phytoremediation, and then the big movement came from Congress. Congress said, okay, we're recognizing hemp is a valuable crop for America's farmers. Go ahead, states. You all are authorized to grow it. You don't need a DEA permit. No other law is going to prevent you from doing it, but it has to be done by your university or your state departments of agriculture. And these are research projects to begin with. The research is going to come up and show how valuable this crop is, and then I believe Congress will just remove all restrictions, and it'll be like growing wheat or other products that you don't need to go and ask, Mother, may I? You're going to be just allowed to do it.
Now, was that in the new farm bill? The provision to allow states to grow it now? Because there was something in the recent farm bill.
The farm bill is the one that said we're taking industrial hemp out from under the Controlled Substances Act, and we're taking it out from any other legal restriction, and states can grow it, but it needs to happen through their departments of agriculture or their universities. So this bill, Senate Bill 2175, which is up on the governor's desk waiting for his signature, this bill is allowing, it's going to be CTAR, the College of Tropical Agriculture, in conjunction with the State Department of Health, and Dr. Harry Ako will be the principal investigator for the project.
Well, that sounds very exciting. And if you're just joining us right now on KKCR, we're speaking with Cynthia Thielen. She's the state representative from the 50th district here on Oahu. It's Kaneohe Bay and Kailua, yeah?
That's correct. That's correct, Jonathan. I am so excited about this, and I guess because it's been such a long struggle. I mean, 20 years from when Peter Thielen said, "Mom, why isn't Hawaii growing industrial hemp to keep our agricultural land in production and to provide jobs?" And he was absolutely right. But it's taken that long to move us this far, and I believe that I have no reason to believe that the governor won't sign the bill, and in fact, we've asked for a ceremonial signing so we can wear hemp shirts and go up to the governor's chambers while he signs Senate Bill 2175, House Draft 2, into law.
That sounds exciting. How soon and where in the archipelago do you think hemp seed will go into the ground and start growing?
The project can begin July 1st. That's in the bill itself. So it would take a little bit of time to get the seed shipped here from China. And so the timing is perfect. Get the location identified, get the hemp seed over here, and then it can begin July 1st.
Any estimation on how long it will take for this project to go through fruition and then perhaps more projects to begin? I mean, other areas and maybe even wider scale production of hemp?
Excellent questions, Jonathan. The hemp crop itself grows very quickly. Within like 120 days, it will be mature. And so the project itself can move ahead quite quickly with the research being done on how much contamination has been pulled up by the hemp crop. Once this happens, I believe that people will take a look at it and say, this makes wonderful sense for our agricultural land that has been contaminated because of the pesticides. So I think that while we begin with a single spot, I would say within probably less than a year, it will be expanded much more widely. Well, the bill itself provides for a single spot, and fine. But then when you get the results from that, then there's no reason not to expand it. And this measure, the expansion, could be put into law very quickly right at the beginning of the next legislative session next January.
So the two criteria or factors that are going to be examined are and quantified, yeah, is the ability of industrial hemp to actually draw toxins and pesticide residue out of the soil. That's the one thing. And then the second thing is processing the seed into biofuel.
Exactly. You're correct. The first will the phytoremediation will go first. And then as a side effect, I'm sure that there will be scientists looking at the biofuels aspect, because it could be, I mean, we know Henry Ford drove his cars on hemp seed oil. Now, how possible is this to make this into an airplane fuel? I mean, you're talking major breakthroughs if we could use hemp for airplane fuel.
What is the scale of this first test project in terms of acres or hectares?
It'll probably be about a half-acre site, depending upon which location where it's put. Before, when it was out in Wahiawa, it was a half-acre site on the Dole property out in Wahiawa. And I had asked the people at Dole to partner with the project back then, so they gave the project use of the site for the period of time it was in operation. People are excited about this. It's it's really a major breakthrough. And the new director of the State Department of Agriculture has been one of the strongest proponents and helpers as we've moved this legislation through the different bodies.
Well, it sounds very exciting indeed, even though Half Acre isn't a particularly large-scale project. I think that our phone lines are open at 826-7771. If you have listening have a question that you'd like to ask Representative Thielen, would you be willing to stick around for a few questions?
I would be glad to.
All right, great. Again, that number is 826-7771. And if you have any questions or comments for Representative Thielen, please do feel free to call in.
Ms. Thielen, did you contact any other of the countries where they grow industrial hemp?
I've actually been to them.
China,
during this
Canada.
20-year period, on my own dollar, I was able to go to a region in France that's called the Champagne region and stood in a hemp field where the crop was probably about 12 to 15 feet tall.
That's high.
Very dense. Oh, it does. It grows very tall. Very densely, very dense growth, like tall stalks of maybe of corn side by side by side. And it was amazing. They of course, never outlawed hemp. It never would have occurred to them to outlaw hemp.
Well, the French have a certain je ne sais quoi. They don't like to do things that are super stupid.
No. And actually, Germany has grown industrial hemp. England, I was able to visit some areas there, too. And the Queen's horses sleep on hemp bedding because it's much more absorbent, and it doesn't mold, and it doesn't draw bugs in it. So I thought, if it's good enough for the Queen's horses, why aren't we having this available for our animals here?
Right.
We know that hemp seed is a superior animal food.
Yeah,
and
it's a wonderful...
as for bird seed, if you have hemp seed in your bird feed, the birds will just adore it. That's what they'll go for first.
Well, there's a lot of human food products, too, like hemp milk and hemp flour.
You're right, yes. Go to the markets, including Costco. Costco has... do you have a Costco on Kauai?
Well, depending if you think it's good or bad, you'd be happy or sad.
But they do have hemp seed products. And,
we do have one here.
Take a look at what they have. It's widely available now.
Well, we've got a caller standing by with a question or comment for you. Aloha, caller. You're on the air.
Aloha. Thank you so much, both of you, all three of you, for the great show. I wanted you to answer a few questions for the populace, perhaps. You just touched on the food thing, which is really great, because to me it's about food. And hemp is one of the highest quality and nutritious foods on the planet. So I want to make sure everybody knows that.
Well, you certainly are well educated,
yes.
And that is so true.
Yes.
Because, and unfortunately, when the nutritionists put out information about you should eat maybe more fish, more salmon, more this, that, and the other, they don't include hemp as one of the items that would be far superior.
Right? Yeah, lots of essential fatty acids and aminos in there.
All your omega-3s and 6s and plus some. The other, the part I want to get to that I think is often, you know, people are always looking up and saying, yeah, but what about this? And one of the things that comes up a lot, and I hope this isn't a weird area to go, but people that grow hemp medicinally for using cannabis for medicine, there's lots of talk out there about how having an industrial crop is going to interfere with their medicinal crops. And I think that there's got to be a really good argument for how this really isn't that big of a problem, and that we can have both if we need to. But most importantly, industrial hemp is so far, it's the primary crop as I see it. And that the cannabis medical crop, I'm all about that if you need to use that. And a lot of people do. And I just would like to hear what you can say to everyone to say, look, we can do both. There is a way to do both.
I absolutely think we can do both. I think it's a location issue. And I think that the scientists that work with these, both of these different crops, would be able to deal with that so both can be grown, so it isn't an either-or, because it isn't an either-or in other nations
right.
that have industrial hemp and have always had industrial hemp and then also have medicinal cannabis as well.
Right.
So it's not a one or the other. Thank you, Bill, for asking that.
Yeah, thanks. I just really wanted you to cover those two areas that I feel like people are like, don't get quite the information there. And as a gardener myself and as a, you know, a community gardener, we're with large areas on the west side that we need to be cleaning. We're ecstatic about this. You know, currently I have to purchase sun hemp as a nutrient to use to plant for a cover crop. If I could be purchasing an industrial hemp for a cover crop, the difference that that would make in the kind of food that I could grow and be removing all of these toxins.
Absolutely.
Fabulous.
Absolutely.
So we're stomping our feet and raising our arms and saying thank you, and thank you for all your work. And all I want to say again is that I think it's important for all of us to remember in these times that although anything can be used for fuel, any kind of vegetable oil, that we should all be thinking about what can be used for food first and what is the highest nutrient food available, and that's what we should be growing. And I just want to put that plug in there because the way that we use corn for ethanol is a very, very sad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we've ruined our corn crops, our high-valued, diverse corn crops. We've limited them. We have very little now, and we've messed it all up. So I hope that we won't make that same mistake with hemp, and I hope that we'll keep a diverse crop of hemp going, and there'll be plenty for good food. So blessings. Thank you both.
Well, thank you so much for your educated comments. I really appreciate that.
If you're just tuning in, this is Out of the Box on KKCR 91.9 here on most of Kauai and 104.7 on Oahu if you are tuning in there. I guess we have about 400,000 potential listeners on Oahu, so that's exciting to be broadcasting to the neighbor islands like that. We've got Cynthia Thielen, Representative Cynthia Thielen, as our guest. And the phone lines are open, 826-7771, if you have a question. And we've got a caller standing by right now. Aloha, caller, you're on the air. Welcome to Out of the Box.
Hi, thanks for having me. I have two brief questions. One is when I heard about this bill, I wrote to a guy over at the University of Hawaii, and his comments were the bill is, I'm going to kind of quote a private email, but I'm not going to quote his name. It says, the bill is unnecessary because research on hemp can be done right now. If a faculty member wants to do it and can obtain the funds to do it, the bill doesn't change anything, and it doesn't provide any funds. So I was wondering if you might be able to comment.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jonathan, if I'm correct, I'm going to state what I thought he said, that the it was a little bit difficult to hear him.
Sure.
It was asking about funding.
Better.
Funding for the project?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the funding is
No,
that's not what it is. I'm sorry, I didn't know you couldn't hear me. I could speak slower and repeat it better.
Sure, try speak directly into your phone, caller.
All right, yeah, sorry, I was trying to read my laptop. I'm moving it over. So, it's an email I got from a guy at the University of Hawaii that I wrote to, so I'm not going to use his name or anything because it's a private email, but I was asking him exactly these kinds of questions you were talking about, and he said the bill is unnecessary because research on hemp can be done right now. If a faculty member wants to do it and can obtain the funds to do it,
you don't even need to tell me who it is because I know, and he is wrong. You could not do industrial hemp research until the federal law was passed, and the Federal Farm Act allows it only if your state has a specific law allowing hemp to be grown. That was an earlier email of this person at University of Hawaii, and he later recanted and realized, okay, you do need the state law to have that happen.
Well, I wrote this email to him at the end of February, so
yes,
it's only a month
been,
and a half
it's
ago.
Been updated as he became educated.
Well, oh, okay. Well, thank you very much for that. And I have one more other question.
Sure, quickly, caller.
Sorry?
Quickly, if you could.
Yes. So when we do the remediation, for a certain number of years, these leaves contain all the contaminants that were in the land. So we can't use that for whatever food and other things. So what will we do with the leaves to get the contaminants away from here?
That's a great question, caller. We'll take that off the air.
Thank you.
Okay. So once the crop pulls the accumulates the toxins from the soil, then the crop itself could be used for biodiesel fuels or industrial lubricants and varnishes.
How do they get the toxicity out of the material?
Okay, let me read this because again, I'm not a scientist, but according to a scientist.
But you are a legislator, and I want to thank you so much for your work in that area.
Thank you.
People working together, that's how we get stuff done, and getting all our paddles in the canoe going the same way.
Absolutely. Well, it states that the products are metabolized by the plant, and they become plant hormones or polyphenols, which make the plants grow better by releasing growth hormones such as auxin. Now, I'm reading that, and if you asked me to explain that any further, I would not be able to do that. But I'm very comfortable with the expertise from the scientists that will be involved, and there's not going to be a problem by pulling contaminants from the soil. And there will be other uses then for that crop.
It sounds like, if I understand what you said there, it sounds like that those toxins are going to be chemically metabolized, broken up into separate pieces by the plant. Maybe you could comment on that, Dave.
That's what you said. Yes.
All right.
That's what she read. Yeah.
Oh, cool. We're all on the same page then. We've got another caller just calling in. Can you stick around for another question?
Another question would be great, and then I do have to go.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the time that you have.
Oh, Jonathan, this is a fascinating program. I'm so glad that you have this.
Well, you know.
You don't have this on Oahu?
I've not turned into it before, and I'm going to see if I can be able to get it from the windward side.
Sure. Well, you can try 91.9 FM if you're on the leeward side of the island, up on the northwest tip. But downtown near the airport and such, we're at 104.7.
Okay.
104.7.
And then what about windward side?
I would check 91.9 and 104.7.
Okay.
Yeah, you can get it at 91.9 at times in Kaneohe. I've heard it there before.
It might be tricky on the other side of the poly, though.
When the weather's good, it's a straight shot there. When it's raining.
Okay, we've got one more caller standing by. Aloha, caller. You're on the air. Welcome to Out of the Box. We're talking with Representative Cynthia Thielen about the recent passage of a bill relating to industrial hemp.
Cynthia, I think you're wonderful, and kudos to you. I just want to say two things. Remember, before the end of the show, give the mailing address for people that are against the dairy, the soil conservation, or some government entity, because where we can write a letter, okay?
All right.
And also, I agree with the other woman caller, you know, while we're going forward with industrial hemp, we don't want to forget that it's okay, marijuana for smoking, medicinal or otherwise, recreational, is still, it's so important to legalize it. It's just so sad that it was made illegal in the beginning, you know, but it's okay to get high on marijuana. That's all I got, and it's for recreational use. It doesn't have to be coined into medicinal marijuana. I can't stand it, even though it can be very medicinal. Anyway, thank you, Representative. I think you're wonderful.
Thank you so much for your comments. I've focused so much on industrial hemp because it has taken 20 years to get where we are now. So that's my main focus. I believe that industrial hemp and cannabis can go side by, well, maybe not planted side by side, but one doesn't mean the other can't be planted. It's just a matter of location, location, location.
I've heard that before.
And that can be done. So I really, I applaud the people of Kauai, by the way, because you all came out very strongly in support of our efforts in 1999 to be able to do the first industrial hemp research project. And as I mentioned, we were the only project in the nation in 50 years to get that permit through the DEA. Now we don't need the DEA. They're out of the picture. They're gone, and we can go ahead and grow industrial hemp, which we will be doing very soon, and I hope that the first seed planting will be close to July 1st. My aloha to all of you, and Jonathan, thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you, but it's not just me. We've got a whole team here, just like you had a whole team helping you get industrial hemp forward. Dave Duro, my co-host, the staff here at KKCR, all the volunteers and listeners. No one person can do any of this stuff by themselves. It's only together that we can.
Absolutely, and that's why your show must be so good, because you have a wonderful team.
Ms. Thielen, do you have some contact information in case anybody wants to contact you about this issue?
I would say, yes, I do. My email is repthielen@capital.hawaii.gov. I would say if people want to support this measure, let the governor know. Sign the bill quickly, please, and we would like to see hemp seed in the ground very soon.
And what's the simple way to refer to this? Should you use the SB2175?
I think the industrial hemp bill, or, and I'd use industrial before it, so the governor will know exactly what it is, because that's its title, and it's SB2175, House Draft 2.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us and sharing updates and information about this important piece of legislation. I think it will really do the state, the people, the soil, the aina quite well, and we look forward to future success.
And I look forward to when it's planted on Kauai. Aloha to all of you and to your wonderful team.
Thank you so much.
Now we have another caller, maybe had a question for the representative, but we'll go to the phones anyway. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you so much, but, you know, it wasn't that as much as, gentlemen, thank you for the great show, you know, as well.
Hey, it's not over yet.
Oh, well, of course not, but for so far what you gentlemen have pumped out has been, you know, phenomenal. I'm glad that the discussion is open. It's in the arena. Kudos to Representative Thielen and what she was putting, but what I really wanted to let her know, along with you guys, hey, man, we're on the Internet streaming, you know? You forgot to give her that if she can't get us on any other radio station.
You know what? You're right, caller. You're another one.
You're
another one of those Akamai listeners.
Yes, I am, and I'm going to hold you to that, you know? Sometimes I help Jimmy on his program, and I'm his sidekick, so I'm just kicking you guys in the side right now.
Okay.
So,
thanks
nonetheless,
for the reminder.
Put it out there.
All right, folks, if you do have Internet access, or the internets, as some people like to say, we're available streaming online worldwide at kkcr.org. You know, that's also a great place. kkcr.org is a great place to go to during our silent drive, which is in celebration of our upcoming pledge drive or membership drive. And you can go there right now and make a pledge or a donation to KKCR. Help keep wonderful public affairs and community affairs like this shows thriving, as well as all the fantastic music and cultural services that we offer.
And if enough people call or get online and do that right now, we'll just cancel the whole pledge drive to begin with, and we'll just play some music and have talk shows.
Yeah, so uninterrupted by polite requests for you to assist us.
I wanted to make a comment then to what one caller said about the growing of medical and industrial hemp side by side. I think that's going to be an issue. If you live,
what's the issue? Maybe you can explain that.
If you live
to
right
people.
Next door to a industrial hemp field,
okay,
and you're growing medical marijuana, that crop is going to pollinate your plants.
And what's wrong with that? What does that mean?
All you will get is a bunch of seeds. you won't get any of the medical marijuana product that you want. So to do that, if you're living next downwind of an industrial hemp field, then you would have to grow it indoors, maybe even have filters to prevent the pollen from coming in and fertilizing the crop. Because when you're growing medical marijuana, you don't want any pollen getting in there.
And why is that?
And fertilizing. Because you want the plant to grow the THC, which is the active ingredient there. But once the THC is grown to create a sticky substance to it to collect the pollen, once it gets the pollen and it fertilizes the plant, it no longer makes any THC, and you may as well be growing industrial hemp yourself.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, you want those sticky kind buds.
That's right.
To keep on growing.
Right, rather than getting fertilized and going to seed. Yeah, so there will be a conflict between the two. I think, you know, it can be managed. Just, you know, they're not going to be growing industrial hemp everywhere. You'll just have to do it in a different location, I think.
So. Relax, man. It's not that big a deal.
That's right. Hey, we got a couple more calls here. Let's go to the phones.
Aloha, caller. Welcome to KKCR Out of the Box. How can I help you today?
Right on. I wanted to check out the so industrial hemp's going to take out the big spaces, and then, you know, there'll be hit or miss places for the medical stuff. Or
hopefully
the,
miss, yeah.
Recreational stuff, okay. A long time ago, I was told that bluegrass or buckwheat, I think it was buckwheat, was so good to turn into your soil because it fertilizes soil and this and that.
Sure, green manure, I think it's called.
Yeah, the green manure. So I had tried it, and I noticed that it's so woody, just like a hemp plant, that it got all tangled up in my turbines, and it wouldn't till under. So I'm just kind of wondering, is it you need to chip it first and then spread it? Because I'm thinking big scale. I'm not talking about just your home, the kind.
No, you're talking about industrial scale hemp.
Exactly.
Like hundreds of acres at a time.
Yeah. So
those are great questions there.
You know, yeah. How do you turn that stuff back into the soil so that it improves it without, you know, I mean, you got serious roots and hardwood stalks and everything like that, that it doesn't decompose overnight.
No, she said that the roots go down as far as 8 feet deep into the soil, and I know that the...
that's a good thing, because that helps break that up down there.
Sure, it also pulls moisture out of the soil so that it's not a very water-hungry crop, I'm given to understand. But the fibers themselves are extremely strong, and one of the ways of processing the cane for fiber and for fabric is to just let them rot or ret on the ground, and then all of the pithy material goes away, and you're left with all of the fiber that remains, a nice clean fiber source. But you know what that means on an industrial scale farm and how you process all that material. It's not just one guy with a pitchfork. I'll tell you that.
I think one of the biggest things that I could stress about industrial hemp, the benefit, is the seeds, because there's vitamins, omega-3 and stuff like that, that you just don't get in your normal eating. And the seeds are really good. You can press them for oil. I think the seed beneficial and the oil, not the oil, but the land fixing issue there.
Phytoremediation.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, that's great. Right?
It's long past due, and I'm glad we're moving in the right direction.
Well, the oil is supposed to cure cancer. I've heard many studies that show that just taking the oil, even orally, can kill cancer cells.
How else would you take the oil, Dave?
There's a number of different ways. It could absorb through the skin. You could... drink it in a smoothie, you know, you could burn it, whatever, you know, there's a lot of different ways, but just to take, you know, the oil, just like people will purify the oil, take a little ball of it about the size of a matchstick, put it under your mouth, under your tongue, and it just slowly absorbs into it, and it's supposed to attack and kill cancer cells.
Wow. Wow, that's so cool.
Yep.
Way cool.
Well, thank you for calling in,
Carl. Thanks for the show, you guys. Aloha.
Aloha. Get another caller. Welcome to Out of the Box.
Hi. This is actually Cynthia Thielen's son.
Is this Peter?
Yes.
Oh,
aloha,
thanks,
Peter. Thank you so much for calling in. That's great.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of KKCR. In fact, I'm one of the guys that keeps the program on the air because I believe in what you folks are doing.
Well, fantastic. Can I ask you a small favor?
Sure.
Could you please tell your mom that we're streaming live on the web at kkcr.org? We forgot to mention that while she was on the phone.
I know. No problem. I will certainly let her know. She can get it on the web.
All right. Thank you.
Not a problem. I guess with some of the different callers calling in and some of the different issues that are coming up, I just don't think that people are getting the proper, either they don't have the proper understanding or there's a book written by Jack Herer called The Emperor Wears No Clothes.
Yeah, The Naked Emperor.
No, it's The Emperor Wears No Clothes.
No, I mean, I was just saying.
No, I'm sorry.
When the Emperor wears no clothes, he's naked, yeah.
Trying to make sure they got a copy of it. This book goes into all of the reasons that hemp was outlawed in the first place, which had a lot more to do with industrial hemp than its medicinal uses.
Yeah, that was just like a side issue.
But what I think in a lot of these people calling in and bringing up this issue and these things with medicinal don't understand was before my mom got on board with the industrial hemp and started speaking to other legislatures about it, the only input that there had been is legalized pot. And I say it like that because that's what most of them heard. And once they heard that, their minds turned off.
Sure, they just shut down.
Yes. So there is a lot of education of the legislature and the people of the state that my mom has done since, like she said, it's been 20 years. And the last bill that got through was in 1999.
Which is like 15 years ago now.
Well, the main point that I wish your listeners to know and understand was up until that point, medical or recreational hemp use had no open ears except for maybe two or three people, which will not get a single bill passed. But after the education that was given through her spending multiple times and hours with much of the people there explaining all of the 25,000 uses for this plant.
I can see why that would take a while.
It became where people opened their hearts and their minds, and the following year we got our medical bill through without any help on her part. But at that point, the people understood and knew the differences and knew something about this plant that their minds and their hearts were closed to for so long.
That's very interesting.
Well, I guess it's to a point that, you know, why would someone worry about what kind of root problem an industrial hemp field is going to have in cleaning up or doing the roots? Do you worry about what the sugar people do and how they get their roots up or the corn people? It's an industrial field. They have that handled. They know what they're doing. You know, it's not, it shouldn't be an issue, I guess.
No, I don't.
And then for the people that are worried about growing their medical near an industrial field, that is definitely going to be an issue that would require them to not let, as industrial hemp is male and female grown closely together, planted inches apart. And that's why there's no way to grow a medical plant in the middle of a hemp field.
Yeah,
but
there's no room there.
So when that was one of the big things that the people in the legislature, when they heard that, they opened their minds and their hearts to industrial hemp. So I guess I'm only speaking to the callers that called in and the other people that are concerned about how industrial hemp will affect medical or recreational marijuana use. I would like them to realize that you need to open people's minds and hearts and educate them to this wonderful plant that humankind has grown for thousands of years. One of the most oldest cultivated plants.
Sure goes
but
back to
But it has
the...
been for many, many uses.
Sure.
And as my mother takes a tablespoon of hemp oil every day for health, which it has more omega-3s than flaxseed. It's the single highest plant food for a balanced diet of the essential fatty acids. And in fact, in China, they eat it roasted hemp seeds like popcorn in theaters. So it is the process of education and getting people to understand the many uses of pot, or I say pot because people think of it that way, but this plant is way, way more than just its medicinal or recreational uses. And I guess I just feel that, you know, she's been doing an awesome job out there to help educate people. And I just hope that the people of Kauai, you know, we don't need to look at everything in black and white. Everything's a shade of gray.
You know, I really like to...
People are that way, that they need education before they're going to open their minds and hearts to other uses.
Yeah, I like to think of the world as being in color, you know, not just
yes,
different shades of gray.
Much better, much better.
Well, thank you.
I'm sorry, but I guess I feel that you know, with all of the stuff that's being done, and you know, it's very difficult because when the last crop was done, the seed came into the country, or pardon me, onto the island. And none of the Department of Ag didn't want to take the seed. Everybody was afraid of taking the possession of the actual hemp seed.
Because it was like
they didn't want to go to jail for 30 years.
It's like a hot potato.
So, you know, all of that is part of the process of education of people. And, you know, just because people are not quite as advanced as we may be here on Kauai, we still have to love our fellow man and work our way through all of these things. So I hope your listeners understand that while her work is directed towards the industrial 25,000 uses, she's well aware of 25,001.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much for calling. Thank you for prompting your mother to push this issue forward, and
yeah, thanks for getting started 20 years ago, because if it takes 20 years to get it done, it's I'm glad you put that effort in 2 decades ago.
Oh yeah, we have a hemp clothing company, like, you know, 20 years ahead of its time, and I guess some kid will come out in another year or two with a surf line, and hopefully will. I mean, I have no animosity towards it. I honestly hope that as more people get educated and turned on, and they realize that as a fabric, back in the old days, everybody wore hemp clothing. And it's way longer lasting than cotton, way stronger. And cotton is the number one poison plant out there, by the way, grown with more poison than any other plants. And, again, I would go back. One last thing is to say, if people really want to be educated, get Jack Herer's book. And you realize that the USS Constitution, the boat that everybody loves and has been rebuilt with nylon sails and rope.
Oh, you're not talking about the document. You're talking about the ship.
Had over 25 tons of hemp rigging. The hemp was put between the boards so that when the boards did not let water leak through, it was used to make all the ropes and sails of all boats. In fact, the word canvas comes from cannabis. So there's been a lot of things that people have been uneducated about or hidden from them by, you know, I mean, the government even denied that Hemp for Victory film until someone found an old copy of it.
Right. Hey, thank you very much for calling. Sounds like the,
sure,
the
you
wall,
guys have a great day.
The walls are coming down around this issue.
Yes, and please remember to tell your viewers, if they want to be more educated, get Jack Herer's book. It's the best out there.
Thanks so much.
All right.
Aloha.
Bye.
Hello, caller, you're on the air. Thanks. Welcome to Out of the Box.
Thanks for being patient.
Hi, I just wanted to reiterate what he said about educating is the biggest important thing to do. And there is another book that's promoted by Real Goods, that company. And I don't remember the name of it, but I read it recently. I don't remember the author. But
Well, what do you remember, caller?
I remember
she
that
liked it.
that I know for sure that people who grow medical marijuana or medical hemp or whatever you want to call it, understand completely that they will be forced to grow indoors, and they don't mind because they know, they also understand the full potential of hemp, and it's a marriage made in heaven. They can go indoors and grow what they wanted with what, you know, the medical portion of that plant, which is different than hemp, and hemp can flourish outside. And the remedial part, oh, that's the other thing I read about, the remedial part of the hemp plant is the leaf, not the stems, because the stems take a long time to break down, but that's what they use to harvest. What they do is they try to grow them all the same size when they're growing fields of it, and then it's easier for their machines to handle and produce the fibers that they need to do rope or clothing or whatever.
Sure, and then when they're all growing closely, they're all competing for the sky, so they all grow straight up and you get longer fibers.
And here's the other cool thing, is that because they grow so close together, they shade the earth underneath their plants, and they can force any bad weeds out. So if you planted in a place where there's a lot of weeds that come up that are invasive, they'll choke them out. So that's the other really good remedial thing about growing hemp real close together, is that you can get rid of maybe even super weeds, who knows?
Oh, and I see, and then you don't have to use a lot of...
You don't have to use chemicals because the hemp will force it out.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you so much for calling in.
Okay, so I'm excited about where we're going with this, and I hope that everybody wants to read about it and goes online and looks it up and says, let's do it. So
right.
On that, I want to say, you know, let's go forward.
All right. Aloha, thanks.
Good thing. Bye.
So we've been talking about the dairy farm in the south, in Mahalepu. We've been talking about hemp for victory here in Hawaii. And I also wanted to bring up a new topic. We don't have a lot of time left, but I wanted to let you know that the PTA is going to be expanding drone use here in Hawaii. And now when I say PTA, I don't mean the Parent-Teacher Association. I'm talking about the Pahakuloa Training Area on Big Island, as well as PMRF here on Kauai. They recently passed legislation. They're going to be importing a whole ton of new drones, military drones, three types, the Shadow, the Blackjack, and the Raven. The Shadow, or the RQ-7, is about $1 million apiece, and it's for surveillance, recon, target acquisition, and battle damage assessments. The Blackjack, or the RQ-21, also about $1 million apiece, is part of the Air-Sea Battle Doctrine. That's going to be used by the Navy. They'll be launching them from ships. And then we've got the Raven, the RQ-11 Raven. These are for combat missions. They're pretty tiny. They're launched by hands, and they give soldiers in combat situations over-the-ridge surveillance ability so they can see in real time what's going on in the next valley over. Pretty exciting, huh, Dave?
I'm not excited by this type of technology. I'm sure there's some better applications of it, but those don't get me excited.
Hmm. How come?
They're killing machines. I don't like killing anything.
Gee, Dave, you say that like it's a bad thing.
Killing is a bad thing? Well, I'll kill hemp plants after they're grown so I could use the product out of it.
So you don't think leveraging the strategic location of Hawaii to bring together international government and industry representatives sounds like a good idea?
Well, I'm sure there's money to be made in that.
Choke.
Yeah. Imagine some peaceful applications of that technology. I don't know. Can you imagine any that for drone... You know, disaster relief.
Humanitarian aid.
Well, they tried to get drones to deliver packages.
Oh, yeah, for Amazon. Right.
You know, you just have a little drone show up on your doorstep there, drop a book or something.
Beep, beep,
out there.
Beep.
So that would be more. But those, they won't allow those anymore.
Hmm. Well, I do know that Hawaii is one of the few airspaces that are open to the deployment of drone technology.
Why is that?
Because Hawaii is one of the most militarized states in the union.
And not as much conflict with other air traffic?
Yeah, the military doesn't see any conflict with military aircraft in the military zone. And this is the, yeah, one of the most militarized state in the union. They're more the ratio of land that's controlled by military forces, either, you know, any one of the branches of the Pentagon. It's far greater than any other state in the nation.
Wow, that's not something to be proud of.
Well, it highlights the role of land forces in the Asia Pacific theater, in peace as well as in war.
Theater, they make it sound like it's something fun to go to.
Yeah, it's the Asia Pacific theater. You can go sit in a nice comfy chair and
eat some hemp popcorn.
yeah.
Watch the show.
Uh-huh.
Hey, we've got just a couple minutes left in the show. Got a couple of calls online we're not going to be able to get to, so unfortunately, I'll have to catch you on the next show. But it was a really good show. Thank you for the callers and the guests that we had, Cynthia Thielen and Bridget Hammerquist. I think somebody asked for the contact information for Bridget Hammerquist.
You got that?
Yeah, Bridget Hammerquist at HawaiianTel.com. HawaiianTel.com.
Got to spell it out, though.
Yeah, you can find it on the Internet. So anyway, thanks a lot. We'll be back in another couple weeks. Next week, Jimmy will be in the studio. And coming up next, we've got a great edition of Acoustic Luau with a special guest DJ.
So. Yeah, and heading out of the show, I wanted to pinch a riff off of one of the riff pinchers from the station here, as well as emulating one of our fine musical DJs here, and wishing everyone peace, harmony, and happiness throughout the world.
I'll second that. Aloha.
Ahui ho.
Going out with little Jackson Brown.
I don't remember losing track of. Always dancing in and out of you. I must have thought you.